Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Rajiv Chandrasekaran from The Washington Post, whose latest book is Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. This book details the history of the Green Zone during the occupation of Iraq, which would be from shortly after the invasion up until the Iraqi government was formed and took over the infrastructure of Iraq. Let me start by asking you, you were there this entire time during that period, which would have been what, 2003, March or April 2003 until 2005?
June 2004.
Right? While this was going on, your book details what we can now call incompetence, cronyism, partisanship, and a kind of misplaced idealism. While this was going on, how aware were you that things were falling apart? Was it like watching a train wreck in slow motion?
Yes, on the outside. And what I mean by that is you could see Iraq starting to crumble. You could see the violence increasing. You could see and hear people becoming increasingly frustrated and angry and dispirited. You could see the infrastructure in its tattered state not getting rebuilt. All of that was easy enough for foreign correspondents like myself to witness. What we didn't see at the time was how dysfunctional the Green Zone was, how crazy of an environment it was inside that palace where Ambassador Bremer and all the other civilians worked, because they did a very good job of keeping the news media at an arm's length, doing a lot of elaborate photo ops and other staged events that really kept us from seeing just how the sausage was being made. And so it wasn't until the occupation had ended and many of the people who had worked for that occupation government had come back to the United States, back to their normal lives, their regular jobs, and I started to track them down and talk to them. Did I fully understand the depth of the ineptitude and incompetence and dysfunction that was the Coalition Provisional Authority?
So most of the interviews in the book concerning the people in the period were done afterward. They weren't done at the time. Is that correct?
There's a lot of reconstructive reporting. I was there for the entire period of the occupation, and a good chunk of the book does result from reporting I did while I was there. But I then sort of backfill in places with reconstructive reporting to really flesh things out and to get at a degree of detail and information that just eluded all of us at the time. Otherwise, you know, I would have written more of this stuff in the pages of the Washington Post. People say, you know, why did you wait to publish Imperial Life in the Emerald City? Why didn't you just tell us all of this stuff while it was happening? And had I known that we were asking people who were being sent out to Iraq for their views on things like Roe versus Wade and whether they were members of the Republican Party, I would have put that in the pages of the Washington Post at the time. I mean, that's too good to sit on. But in many of these cases, it wasn't clear to me until months had gone by.
Well, you also had witnessed things like Rumsfeld's Stuff Happens and the looting of the Iraqi Museum. Something must have been going on in your mind at that point, some head-scratching at least. How much head-scratching was there, even though you didn't know the details and couldn't report it? What was your view, or were you so in it that you couldn't even see that?
I was, quite frankly, flabbergasted from the very earliest of days. You know, we had tens of thousands of American troops in Baghdad, yet they were doing nothing to prevent the looting, not just of the National Museum, which I was among the first reporters to walk through, but all the other Iraqi government installations, save for the Ministry of Oil. You know, they weren't doing anything to restore basic order on the streets. They didn't have a plan for governance and reconstruction. Then they went about doing stupid things like debathification and the dissolving of the Iraqi army. And being there in Baghdad and being witness to all of this, it was incredibly frustrating because the Iraqi people, make no mistake about it, they were grateful to be liberated from Saddam Hussein. Nobody liked the old dictator, save for, you know, a handful of his cronies. So the Iraqi people were actually really happy and they were optimistic. We as Americans had political capital there. What was so difficult to understand was how we managed to sort of squander that goodwill and political capital literally in a matter of weeks and months, and just to see day by day how we turn people who were our friends, who were so grateful, into people that became our enemies and became embittered.
Then let me ask you, just on speculation, let's suppose for a second Bremer hadn't come in. Let's suppose the military had stayed in charge a bit longer and the politicalization of the occupation hadn't happened. Where do you think we'd be today? I'm sure it's gone through your mind.
It certainly has. I don't think that things would be perfect today. I think there would probably still be something of an insurgency. There would probably be some degree of sectarian conflict. But I think that things could have turned out an awful lot better had we sent the right people, had we had a real plan for the transition to an Iraqi-led governing authority early on, had we actually followed through with some of our promises in reconstruction, had we empowered Iraqis, had we not turned Iraqi Sunni community into enemies by telling them through de-Ba'athification, through the dissolving of the army, that they had no place in the future of Iraq, which literally helped to spark sectarian conflict. Had we not done those things, I think Iraq would have muddled along. I don't think it would have been anybody's great success story, but I don't think it would have been the disaster that we see today.
So the sectarianism that we're looking at, a lot of that is directly an outgrowth of the incompetence, let's say, of the administration.
Well, I think that there is a connection. I'm not going to blame all of the sectarian conflict on decisions made by the CPA and the Americans in Baghdad. That would be wrong. There are some long-standing tensions between Iraq Sunnis and Shiites. But you also have to understand that despite historical tensions, Iraq Sunnis and Shiites did get along. You know, there were more Sunni-Shiite mixed marriages in Iraq than in any other Muslim country. Sunnis and Shiites lived next door to each other in Baghdad and other major cities. There was a spirit of tolerance and moderation that was very unique in Iraq. Of course, things did get worse after the 1991 Gulf War, and the tension did grow. But when the Americans came, they automatically just sort of said, okay, Shiites, you're the oppressed minority. We will empower you. Sunnis, you're the bad guys. You were all in cahoots with Saddam. We're going to marginalize you. And they didn't say it explicitly, but that was the gist of a lot of these policies. That was the gist of de-Ba'athification. It was the gist of dealing with the army. And the message was unmistakable to leaders of the Sunni community. They looked at all this and said, you know, we're going to get cut out. We have no real seat at the table anymore. And then Bremer set up a governing council, and he put five Sunnis on it. But they were all fairly weak Sunnis that really had no standing in the community, and other Sunnis would look at it and say, ah, they're just willing to take a few guys who will say what they want to say to them, as opposed to people who are legitimate. And it helped to make the Sunni community increasingly embittered. And I think it helped to push people toward the insurgency.
Rajiv Chandrasekharan, let me ask you this. The Atlantic Monthly put out an article. I don't remember who wrote it right now. And the correspondent who was writing it talked about how the entire Green Zone Authority under Bremer was, in essence, a bizarre experiment in free market capitalism, as if somehow the experimenters had taken over and were guiding Iraq toward some kind of ideological purity. Is that something that you saw at that point? It's kind of hinted at in your book, but never said quite outright as it is in that Atlantic Monthly article.
Well, I think I do get into it to some degree in the book. I mean, I write about how Bremer's initial wave of economic advisors, you know, looked at a country with 40% unemployment. That's a conservative figure, maybe 50%. And, you know, among their first priorities was to engage in tax code reform. They rewrote Iraq's tax code line by line. They gave them a dream of the neocons, a 15% flat tax. I mean, I suppose if anybody's looking for tax relief, they should move to Baghdad. But it wasn't just that. I mean, they went about trying to rewrite banking laws and tariff laws. They wanted to privatize industry. part of Bremer's plan, I mean, Bremer's goal was not just to bring democracy to Iraq. It was to really bring free market economics, to make Iraq safe for capitalism. And they pursued those goals with just as much vigor and fervor as they did the democratization goals. And in fact, you know, on one hand, you know, the Iraqis, they were into democracy. They knew they didn't want dictatorship. But as I write about in the book, it wasn't like they had come around to embracing the idea of free market economics. They thought that the socialist system they had under Saddam was just fine. They didn't understand why the Americans were saying to them, you need to completely turn your economy on its head and to embrace all of these things that we're bringing to you. And that created an awful lot of tension and I think, again, helped to sap elements of goodwill.
There was also that condescension, almost a British imperial view. The parallels to what happened with Britain and the way it dealt with its colonies, watching Bremer in your book, it seems like almost the same thing, and nobody seemed to have caught on. Or did they?
It certainly felt like that to me. I mean, okay. You see that in the title of the book, Imperial Life. You walk through the green zone, and you saw, you know, Gurkhas guarding the palace. The Americans who worked in there, you know, bemoaning what they felt were the slothful habits of the Iraqis. You know, there was definitely this sort of feeling of, you know, the Raj reborn on the Tigris.
After Iraq came Katrina. When you watched from afar what was going on in New Orleans, obviously you must have seen connections with what had happened in Iraq.
It all made sense to me. It totally did. I looked at what was happening with FEMA and with Michael Brown, and I said, I've seen this sad play before. I saw it in Baghdad. You know, I often say that the CPA was sort of Michael Brown times 100. But when I first started hearing about the politicization of the CPA, on one hand, I reacted with some degree of disbelief. I was like, no, there's no possible way they actually would do this sort of stuff. But as I went about reporting and talking to more people, it became clear that indeed it did happen. And I was very surprised. And then Katrina hit. And Katrina hit in the summer that I was working and writing the book. And the whole Michael Brown fiasco, it clicked. It started to make sense. And then, you know, more recently, the whole U.S. attorneys controversy. These are all data points. And I think that in some ways, they all sort of somehow fit together. And so what I saw in Baghdad, you know, I don't think was any sort of great anomaly. I think in some ways it is emblematic of the way this administration has approached hiring people and staffing its bureaucracies.
I guess it surprises me that they don't learn anything, the administration.
Well, you know, I think that there probably was a consensus that FEMA failed spectacularly during Katrina. But, you know, there's still a lot of people in government who think that the Coalition Provisional Authority did a pretty good job, that they helped to get Iraq back up on its feet. I wouldn't underestimate the number of people who don't accept that the CPA was not our finest moment in American foreign policy.
Well, you wound up writing the book, but other reporters, you guys must have sat around and understood this. And afterward, I'm sure you spoke with reporters who kind of said, yeah, this is what we saw as well. Do you think a reporter has any responsibility at the time to talk to anybody about this? I mean, anybody in the green zone?
We did. We tried to talk to people in there about it, and we did write stories. I mean, I'll you know, sort of draw your attention to a three-part series I wrote in the Washington Post totaling some 11,000 words about the failings of the CPA that were published while the CPA was still, you know, doing its thing in 2004, generated a lot of controversy. It also helped to form the basis for this book. You know, we were trying our best. But remember, you know, they'd imposed a sort of a White House-like strategy of dealing with the press. You know, you couldn't just wander the halls of the Republican Palace without an escort from the Strategic Communications Office. American personnel who worked for the CPA were told in no uncertain terms that if they spoke to reporters without a minder present, they'd be packed up on the next C-130 and shipped home. So it was really tough. I mean, did I sneak into the palace? Yes. Did I make friends and have them kind of, you know, Spirit me in. Yeah, I mean, there was a case where I was walking down the hall with a friend of mine, and we saw Dan Senor, Ambassador Bremer's spokesman, walking the other way. And I literally dove into an office so he wouldn't see me. But you had to resort to things like that. And so it was tough to see the whole picture. But I think we all did try to get elements of it as much as we could into the media at the time.
Does that include the television media as well? Did you see the same kind of effort from them?
Well, I have to confess, I'm not a good person to judge how the American television media covered Iraq in the first 15 months, because I was in Baghdad. I wasn't watching them. The TV in my office was tuned to the BBC World Service. I wasn't watching any of the American TV networks.
When you came back, did you see a major disconnect from what you had seen in Iraq with what was being reported in America generally? And I'm not talking about the Washington Post or the Knight Ridder newspapers here. I'm talking about just generally media.
You know, I think television has a tendency to dramatically oversimplify things. And I did see at times a disconnect. I mean, I don't want to disparage the work of a lot of very brave colleagues there who I think try, even on the TV side, you know, in the confines of a two-minute nightly news piece, try to pack in an awful lot. But they do have to dumb down. They have to write to pictures. A lot of the complexity of Iraq just doesn't come through through the broadcast media, unfortunately. I think, you know, NPR has done a pretty good job, and I also think some of the major newspapers have. But if you're sitting here in the United States trying to really understand what's happening in Iraq, it's tough. You've got to be going to multiple sources and really sort of weighing one set of reports off against another. It's very challenging.
Have you been back to Iraq since the book?
Not since the book. I've had a couple of trips that have been canceled for various reasons. I'm hopefully heading back at some point this summer, but I have not been back since the book has been published.
You've talked to people who are there. What are they saying about what the Green Zone is like now?
Well, the Green Zone's even worse now. I mean, the Green Zone isn't just one fortified enclave, but it's a collection of sort of mini fortified city-states within the overall Green Zone. You know, the American Embassy has its own walls and own barbed wire and own guard towers, as does, you know, the intelligence offices there, as do the contractors, as does the USAID compound. And then there's another part of the Green Zone where the Iraqi government leadership lives and works, Prime Minister al-Maliki and members of his cabinet. And this also creates a problem because, you know, Maliki in many ways is just as isolated, just as cut off from the Iraqi people as Ambassador Bremer was. He's not out there walking the streets and pressing the flesh and talking to people. He's in his own bunker. And so, you know, in some ways it's easy for him to make various promises to American officials that he's going to do X or Y or Z, but in many ways, what he and his advisors are planning or thinking is cut off from what's really occurring on the streets of Baghdad.
So that government is almost a ghost government.
Or as many Iraqis might say, they don't find the government to be particularly representative of them.
At this point, polls seem to show Iraqis want Americans to leave, but we've also heard rumors of permanent bases and a permanent presence. How much credence should we give those rumors?
You know, I think we should give them credence, but it's hard to know exactly what those plans are. You know, I've been to many bases where they've poured concrete and built some what look like pretty permanent structures. Now, the Pentagon often builds permanent structures and then knocks them down months later. So that's no real indication of how long they're going to stay. At the same time, you know, the military has on its installations in other parts of the Middle East trailers that look like they could be packed up and shipped out, you know, tomorrow, but they've been there for years. So, you know, just looking at kind of the physical construction of these places is a bit misleading. Look, the United States has largely shut down its military installations in Saudi Arabia. It needs a place to house troops and project force to Iran and to Syria and more generally in that part of the world. And, you know, Iraq is the place. And so even if we withdraw from the streets of Baghdad, I think the Pentagon is always planning on keeping some form of garrison in parts of Iraq, and particularly in the northern parts of Iraq in the Kurdish-controlled region. I just don't think that we're going to see a situation anytime soon where, you know, the number of American troops in Iraq falls to zero.
So this is an ongoing thing, even when we talk about, oh, let's pull out by such and such a date. Even then, after that, there would still be Americans there. At least that's what the Bush administration seems to be hinting at by what they're doing.
Well, yes, and there would also be, even under the Democratic proposals, there would still be Americans there to guard the embassy, to guard reconstruction work. I mean, you could redefine their mission in a variety of ways, to provide training. I mean, you could have 40, 50,000 American forces there to do other things other than quote-unquote combat. So a redeployment doesn't, you know, necessarily mean everybody back home.
Rajiv Chandrasekharan, in reading your book, some of the funniest parts concern life in the Green Zone, this strange place with all these young Republicans running around. You mentioned the whole sex thing. There must have been a lot of that going on. There must have been gay sex going on. It must have been a wild time. There were all these people under 30.
Yeah, you know, you had a lot of young people, a lot of hormones, people away from home. Things do happen. You know, people who were married began to refer to themselves as, quote-unquote, operationally single. There were, you know, I think a fair bit of illicit activity happening out there.
What about, say, drugs, pot, all of that? Did you see any of that there?
Strangely, no.
Really?
Now, was there some, perhaps? I never came upon it. Not in the same way that, you know, I've read about how journalists in Vietnam came upon that stuff. I saw a lot of alcohol. I heard stories about methamphetamine use and sort of types of methamphetamine that were purchased on the Iraqi streets, you know, from pharmacies, that sort of thing. But that was about it. I didn't see or hear of a lot of marijuana use. Part of the reason is, you know, in Vietnam and places like that, that stuff grows naturally, or at least, you know, can grow with some basic cultivation. Whereas in a desert environment, it's kind of tough to produce that.
And the whole Christian thing inside the Green Zone, did you see a lot of that?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of different church services on a regular basis. There were Bible study classes. There were a lot of people there who made little secret of their religious affiliation. You know, they didn't say outright that they saw themselves as on a crusade, but I think that there certainly were religious overtones to it for some of the people who were there.
George Tenet's book has come out. Has that changed your perception of what went on at all?
I have to confess, I haven't read his book yet, but in reading reviews of it, reading news articles about it, it hasn't really. I mean, I think what we're going to see over the next couple of years are a lot of Bush administration insiders writing books that aim to cast themselves in the most favorable light and wind up trying to stab others. You're going to see this from Doug Feith. You're going to see it from other senior officials in the administration. So, you know, it's going to be hard to know what really happened. You know, it's going to be the memoir version of history. People are going to write history as they interpreted it and is most favorable to them. You know, Ambassador Bremer's already done so. He's written a book that casts his service there in the most favorable light possible.
Have you spoken with anybody that you interviewed since the book has come out who approached you or you spoke to and said something like, you know, I didn't realize how bad things were, and I'm kind of sorry about it now?
You know, by the time I started writing the book, a number of the people who were there had begun to really have a crisis of conscience. I joke that there were people who went over there as true believers. Many of them came back as true believers, and they thought success was just around the corner. You know, another 2 months, 3 months, things would be fine. And when that didn't happen, you know, there's a whole class of people who would work for the CPA who are in sort of desperate need of therapy. And I provided it to them for free with a couple of cups of coffee in my notebook. But, yes, there have been people who I've talked to for the book who, after having read the book and having read about all that happened and all the dysfunction, you know, people who might have been working in economics but had no idea that, you know, the world of healthcare and education and other things were just as dysfunctional because they were all working in their little silos in the Green Zone. They've approached me and said, wow, I had no idea it was like this. It's been, in some ways, eye-opening for the very people who participated in this process.
When you hear about the surge, what goes through your mind?
What goes through my mind is that the Republicans and the Democrats are both fundamentally misreading the situation out there. You know, you've got the president and his advisors saying, if you can create improved security in parts of Baghdad, political leaders will move forward with national reconciliation, and Iraqis will put more stock in their government. Well, I actually think General David Petraeus will be able to improve security in parts of Baghdad with more troops. I think that that's totally realistic. But will improved security in some neighborhoods lead the political elites to make the grand compromises they need to make in the Green Zone? I think that's far less certain, and I think that it's even more uncertain whether ordinary Iraqis will then say, you know what, we're going to put down our weapons now that there's an oil law and now that de-Ba'athification has changed, and we're going to put some stock in this government. I just don't see that happening. At the same time, you know, the Democrats in Congress say, let's give some very specific deadlines to the Iraqis and say, if you don't do this, these things by this time, we're going to redeploy our forces. Well, I think that if you put a gun to Prime Minister Maliki's head, he's not going to engage in the sort of compromise that you want him to. He's going to circle the wagons. He's going to bring in more of his cronies into the government. He's going to bring in those Shiite militiamen back into the Interior Ministry. So, I think that both sides in this debate in Washington fundamentally misunderstand what's happening on the ground in Iraq today.
Then, Rajiv, if you look at this, what do you see? And if you were in a position, what would you do?
Well, you know, my crystal ball ain't very good, and I'm glad I'm not a policymaker. But, you know, I think that, you know, I see a lot of dark, gloomy, violent, bloody days ahead for Iraq. I don't see an easy solution. And I think that although Iraqi leaders now don't like the idea of partitioning their country, and American officials, save for a handful of people like Senator Joe Biden, really are not for this, I think that over the long run, getting both sides to their respective corners of the ring may be the best way to go. I'm not trying to advocate for partition here in this interview, but what I am saying is that that's the direction in which things are headed. You know, my Iraqi friends tell me that the sectarian genie is out of the bottle, and there's no putting it back in. It didn't have to be this way, but now that it is this way, there's no just sort of easily turning off the switch. And so this is the reality that we're going to have to deal with and readjust to, and the Iraqi leaders are also going to have to readjust to this. I pity whoever's going to occupy the White House in January 2009, because they're going to have an awful big problem on their hands. You know, on one hand, nobody's going to want to continue the present policy, but, you know, if you pull everybody out, you know, what happens? Could the daily death toll from the sectarian conflict go from many dozens killed a day to many hundreds or thousands? And would we as Americans, would we who feel so concerned about what's happening in places like Darfur, or were so concerned about what was occurring in the Balkans back in the 90s, would we be able to just sort of sit back and let that happen? And so there's this whole game of trade-offs here. That's why I look at this and say, there's no easy answer. There's no good solution. It's sort of one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't things.
Rajiv, what are you working on now that you're back in the States?
Well, I'm working on some longer-term stories for the Washington Post about our dysfunctional Iraq policy, stories we're sort of tentatively calling the war over the war. I'm not focusing so much on the public theater that's going on in Congress and at the White House, but sort of lesser-told stories about how 4 years into this, Washington is still dealing with Iraq in a dysfunctional way.
You've been listening to an interview with Rajiv Chandrasekharan, whose book is Imperial Life in the Emerald City. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.